You know our slogan around here is better practice, better life. But we're taking this belief to the next level. And we've recently announced the creation of a new association. It's called the Best Practices Association. Our association celebrates the mindset that is better practice, better life. This mindset celebrates time, healthy living, personal growth, clinical excellence, and impacting the lives of your patients and your team through intentional leadership. In fact, we are the work-life balance experts in dentistry. The BPA will coach independent dental practices like yours to thrive by sharing best practices and operational habits, behaviors, systems, tools, and insight that lead to profitability and sustained growth, and you can still have a life. So if you're a dentist that wants to surround yourself with great thinkers, let us help you create your own version of better practice, better life. Go to actdental.com/BPA or hit the link in the show notes. Welcome back to the Best Practice Show. My name is Kirk Barron. I'm your host. And you, again, are in for another amazing treat with Dr. Mark Murphy. We are talking about one of the most important topics in all of dentistry, which is airway. And what do we do and how do we do it? And if you're tuning into this episode, this is the third segment that Mark is going to take us through. We've already talked about the why. We've already talked about the basic sleep physiology. We've talked about screening, and today we're going to get into testing. Now, if at any point you missed the previous podcast, I'm going to encourage you to go back and check those out because this is not going away. This is going to be part of dentistry forever. But as Mark, you and I were talking about before we went live on this, is the piece of the puzzle is, how do I make this work in my practice? And you're laying out a great framework for how people jump in the pool and start swimming instead of trying to watch a video about how to swim. So give us some perspective before we get into testing.
So thanks so much for remembering that that metaphor. You can't learn how to do something like a crown prep. You can't learn how to do something like scaling and root planing. You can't learn how to do something like sleep treatment by just reading it in a book. You have to do it. You actually have to do it. You have to make some mistakes. One of the things you and I were talking about earlier was an old John Wooden quote that I like. Failure is not fatal. Failure to change because of the mistakes you make and try different things differently may be fatal. And so that's the difference that we're talking about here. It's okay if on your first or second or your fourth patient, things don't go perfectly well. It's as long as you're on a learning curve, just like you were with your first crown prep. So getting into the pool and learning how to swim is the only way. You can't read the book.
Right.
So screening patients is important. Knowing about this is important. And that could be, I don't think for somebody who's listening to this part of the next ones, that could be where somebody ends. Somebody could say, I'm screening, Kirk, and I'm done. I screen my patient. I send them to a local sleep dentist who does this, or I send them to my local physician who does this. Wash my hands. That's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But at least they will have fulfilled their ADA requirement to be responsible for screening for sleep-related breathing disorders. So that's cool.
Yeah. And in the last episode, you took us through a great acronym. So I'm not even going to tell you because I want you to go back and listen to it. It's phenomenal and a great way to train your team and yourself to put a framework in here. And Mark, I'm going to kind of tee you up with this question because you and I is where do you think dentists get this wrong when it comes to sleep? They know it's important. They go to a course, they see you speak, they listen to this podcast. They're like, what do they get wrong when they go back to their practice about putting this into play?
Yeah. You know, so the very last session we're going to do is on billing and documentation. And I think where most dentists get it wrong is not figuring out how to get paid for it. And if you don't figure out how to get paid for it, and that could be the mistake of not willing to pay the per claim fee and the percentage that you pay for a third-party medical biller to handle that for you. If you are unwilling to pay for a software platform that allows you to track soap notes and all the information that comes in from the physician so that you can easily coordinate that and literally press buttons to fax or send that information to and from the other healthcare providers. If you're not willing to invest, and it's not much, we're talking about $300 a month maybe for the software, I can't swear to it, but I think I pay $49 a claim and then maybe 8% of whatever's paid. If you're not willing to do that, and you say, I'm not going to pay that, I'm going to do this in Google Docs, or I'm going to do this in my Dentrix or my Eaglesoft, you're going to pull your hair out. You're going to hate yourself, and your team's going to hate you for wanting to do sleep. Oh, and then by the way, the month goes by, the 2 months goes by, 6 months gone by, and those three devices we did, we never got paid for. That's going to be frustrating too, because now this kind of promise you had in your mind of helping patients get healthier, feeling cool about what you did, and then, oh, by the way, we're also going to get paid for this, isn't happening because I don't want to say it this way. I'm not going to say, oh, yes, I am going to say it, because you're too cheap to pay somebody else as a third party to do it for you. Most dentists will never figure out, and their teams will not figure out, because you might do one device a month. You might do one device every 2 weeks or one a week. If you decided to do sleep full time, yeah, maybe you should have somebody full time on your team that you pay $60,000 or $70,000 or $80,000 a year for medical billing. But until you do $1 million or $2 million and you're going to pay 8%, yeah, I'll pay somebody to figure that out for me. But until I get to that phase, I'm going to pay some third party company to do it, and then you'll have peace of mind, because the part that's such a pain in the you know what ski. That goes away. Documentation billing, that final section we'll talk about. And that'll be a brief one too, so that'll be easy. But that's where most people get it wrong. The doing of the sleep. Oh, one more thing they get wrong. Okay. We are used to, got so many things we talk about before we go live, bounce back up. We were talking about how I'm a dentist. We as dentists like to get everything right, 100%, check marks, everything exact. We never see a tooth come in. We never see a problem come in that we can't solve. Because think about it, there's always an elevation that we can control. It's past the point of a filling, or it's past the point of prevention, it's a filling, or it's past the point of a filling, it's a crown. Past point of a crown, it's a root canal, post and crown. It's past that, we're going to do an implant. So there's always a way we can solve that patient's problem. In medicine, the best dental sleep medicine specialists, the best ones, are successful between 70 and 75% of the time. Ooh, there's the other place we get it wrong. We want to help everybody. I, in my role with Persomnus, I take these calls from dentists every day, multiple times per day, helping them work their way through the minefield of dental sleep medicine that are getting started. And they'll say, well, I've got this patient and they don't have any teeth and I'm worried about trying to make them advice. I go, you can't. You just give them CPAP. Oh, but they don't want a CPAP. It's not your problem. Oh, I've got this patient. I treated them. We got them advanced forward. I still can't get their AHI score down. They don't say they're sleeping any better. They're not snoring. They're in the 25%. Can't fix everybody. Yeah. It's so hard for us to accept 75% success as world class. And yet I think to myself, you'd be in the Hall of Fame in every sport if you shot 75%, if you scored 75% of the time, or you batted 750. You'd be in the Hall of Fame of the Hall of Fames. You'd be the GOAT of all time.
Ted Williams, what was his batting average?
406. 406.
And he was the best of all time. Do you know what I mean?
On the last day of the season, when Ted Williams did that in 1941, I think it was, he went 5-for-7. He was technically batting 399.9 something, which they would have rounded up to 400. And so they were going to sit him, and he said, no way. And he got up there and went 5-for-7 and finished the season at 406 in the doubleheader.
I did not know that. That is a great story.
That's how guys that hit 400 hit 400, right? Guys that hit 400 don't step down when it's 399.
There's something inside them that's different than everybody else. So we're going to talk about testing today. So now I think the cool part about this, Mark, is you're giving us a great framework for how we put this into play, and you don't have to do all of this. And so let's talk about testing. So we've done the sleep physiology. We've done the screening. Now there's evidence that this patient could be experiencing some of these symptoms. Take us to the next step. How do you look?
We want to go from risk to certainty. And that's really what we're talking about. And so in our normal dental world, we would be thinking about risk versus certainty. You know, I think that might be a cavity there. I think that might be decay. And so we need more information. What would you do? You run a test. I think that gum might be unhappy there. What do? You put a probe in it. You run a test. In medicine, I'm going to draw your blood and I'm going to look at a whole myriad of things. I'm going to find things that are good and bad and all over the place. You take a radiograph, you take a chest x-ray, you take high blood pressure, we weigh you. In medicine, just like in dentistry, we just don't think of it that way. There's a suspicion of a risk that somebody has for a particular condition or situation. And we confirm it somehow with more definitive information. It might be imaging, might be probing, could be any number of things. Well, in dental sleep medicine, that's the sleep test. I could look at a person that's, I don't want to steal the thunder that you said you have to go back and listen to the other issues, but of the stop bang, I could look at the stop bang. Oops, I slipped it out. STOP. So, you know, do they snore? Are they tired? Is it an observed stop breathing? Do they have high blood pressure? What's their BMI, their age, their neck size, and their gender? And they're at high risk. Does that mean they have sleep apnea? No, but it means 9 out of 10 of that group of people have sleep apnea. How do we confirm that? Ah, thank you for asking. That's what we want the patient. That's what we want the patient to be in the right perspective of. I want the moment of impact for me with that patient at that time to be, they know that something's wrong. They know that this is a bad thing to have. They know that they're at high risk of having it, and they want to find out if they do or not.
Okay,
wait. You don't even have to push.
Yeah, stop right there, because you, I know you love this. It's the behavioral side of dentistry. You can't make people own things. Like, they have to come to a place where they go, wait a minute. This is a problem. Like, it's one thing to say to somebody, you have risk, but open that up for me just a little bit, because I think that's where the magic happens, is when patients take the ownership. And we're really talking about the behavioral side of dentistry, right?
100%. And it doesn't change because we're talking about a medical condition. It's the same learning ladder, the same series of steps that I would want to walk a patient up of. If I were talking to them about crown and bridge and implants or periodontal therapy, some patients are unaware of things and then they become aware. Once they become aware, that's still different than are they interested or not in what's going on. And so I've got a patient here that in this consultation that we did in the screening, they moved from unaware to aware to they're interested in this. And then if I've presented myself, if I've engaged them enough, asked them enough questions, engaged them in conversation, been a good listener, shown them how much I care, then they probably come to trust me a little bit. So that they're looking at me, and you'd have this advantage in a dental practice for the listeners that they're your patients and you've been seeing them for some time. And now you're adding this new screening tool. And so they probably already trust you to some degree. And this new conversation is getting worked in. And now they come to trust you. So unaware, aware, interested, they believe and trust in you. And then they say the magic words, well, what do you think we ought to do? That's where I want a patient to be on that learning ladder, because where we make the mistake so often is I look at a patient who's at high risk and I say sort of flippantly, we need to get you a test. And they don't know why, because they're not fully aware. They aren't that interested. It isn't like they believed or trusted me as their dental sleep medicine consultancy advisor. And they certainly haven't asked me what they think I ought to do about this problem that they're not aware of or not interested in. So we ask them to take an action and they're way down here. Okay. So it's about waiting to see that that patient is in the right preparation. You know the old statement that went up, when a student is ready, the teacher appears. You know that one.
Right.
So, I mean, that's a great statement. Well, it's really the same way. When the patient is ready, then I can tell them what we could do next. And the do next is the sleep test. And right. So it's really this, in sales vernacular, I would say I have to close them into a test. I have to get them to want a test.
Right.
And if they want to push past that and start to talk about treatments and stuff, I'm happy to answer those questions. But first, we got to find out whether or not you have this disease. First, I don't know if you need periodontal therapy. I don't know if you're going to lose your teeth. First, I have to measure your gums. First, I have to do this home sleep test.
Right. Now, this is stuff that is all near and dear to our heart. And I love all of these frameworks for thinking. And one of them that you and I both agree on is, if I give you a fish, eat for a day. If I teach you how to fish, eat for a lifetime. But there are some times you just got to show me how to use the rod and show me how to do this so I can eventually. So give it to me straight. How do you tell a patient, once we're at that point, we now have to go, how would I say that if I'm a dentist listening to this? Okay, so now we're going to transition from screening to testing. Mark, how do I communicate to my patients? What do I say?
So Remember, it's going to be a numbers game. I'm going to tell 10 people and 8 are going to do it. I'm not going to bat 100%. Not going to happen. So first off, you have to accept that. So the first thing I do is what I call a presumptive close. And it's a term that comes from sales. It's a presumptive close that I assume the patient is going to take the next step. Never think that you have to convince them. Just assume, because like in medicine, nobody says to their doctor, when the doctor says, well, we're going to draw some blood today and take an x-ray and we'll see what that looks like. I'll be back in a few minutes. Nobody says, well, wait a minute. How much is that going to cost? What's it going to do? They just let you do that. So presumptive close, let's assume they're going to move forward. Now, remember those 8 slides that you got with that second deck when we're talking about screening and consultations. We've got these slide decks that we sent around with all these different lectures. So you've got the slide decks. There's those 8 slides that are in there that show us the kinds of conversation I'm having with the patient. So they know that this thing called obstructive sleep apnea is serious. A, they know that they're at risk because we've talked about it. B, so they've got A plus B. That means C. Yes, it does. So you know how serious this is. We made that connection for you in the screening and in the basic physiology. We had that conversation. You know that you're at high risk. You had 5 out of the 8 risk factors. So I just look at them like I'm expecting them to say yes. And I go, so let's go ahead and get you ordered up for a sleep test. That's the best thing we need to do right now.
Okay. And then
just like that. And eight out of 10 go. Okay.
Okay. Now I love that. And we're going to set them up with a process and how it all works. Now I want you to talk about the types of tests. If somebody hasn't been around the changes, because I did a sleep test 10 years ago and I remember all the nodes and the connection and all the, and how I couldn't move. They've got new stuff now. You don't have to get loaded up with all these things, right?
So, yeah. So 10 years ago, 90% of the tests were done in a clinic with 100 leads all over your body. It feels like there's no way anybody's going to sleep naturally. There's an observer watching you sleep on a camera and they record gigabytes of data. No question. Today, 85% of the tests are done at home with a home sleep test, which is much less invasive and much simpler to take. We still have both kinds of tests. So there's a little bit of thinking that we have to do as a dentist when we're deciding what we do with this patient. In most states, not New Jersey, not New York, not Ohio, not Virginia, not Alabama, and not Georgia, but in all of the other states, I, as a dentist, can order the sleep test. Okay. I can't read it and interpret it and make the diagnosis, but I can order a prescription for that patient to be tested. And I can use a third-party company that mails the test to the patient. They read the instructions, they put it on in their house, they go to bed, they wear it for a couple nights, they mail it back to the company. We get the results. A sleep physician reads the results, writes the orders for an oral appliance or a CPAP, whatever is appropriate, and we go from there.
Yeah.
The other option I have is I could send them to my local sleep physician, and that could involve a telemedicine visit, by the way, that sleep test that we're doing, test by mail, so to speak, teledoc visit, telemedicine visit, sleep test by mail, sleeptest.com is the one I use, or I could send them to my local sleep physician.
Right.
The local sleep physician then would make a determination, does this patient need a home sleep test just like I wanted to order, or should they go into the clinic and do the overnight observed sleep test. Why do we still have that kind of test? Well, some patients have a lot going on. Some patients have really complex medical histories. Some patients have narcolepsy, sleep latency. They have insomnia. They have all kinds of periodic leg syndromes. They have all kinds of things going on. And a sleep test would not be enough for that patient. So my triage in my mind is, am I confirming or denying that this patient has sleep apnea? Or do I need a broader diagnosis? This patient has a lot going on. If they have a lot going on, I always send them to my local physician.
Right.
I punt. I just go, I can't make that call. I don't want to make that call. I don't want to be responsible for ordering up a sleep test, which checks one box on all the sleep disorders this patient could have that I should have suspected. So I go, this patient is 55, a little bit overweight. They snore. Maybe they got hypertension. Nothing else exciting going on. Boom, sleep test. Confirm whether or not they have obstructive sleep apnea. I can order that test up every single day. But somebody who's had a heart attack, has a stroke, is 65, they're older, they're on 12 different medications that I got to start looking up because I haven't heard of some of these. They tell me they have so much trouble falling asleep or staying asleep. I'm out.
Right.
I'm not ordering a sleep test on that patient. I send that patient to a local physician. And I want to do some of that with my local physician anyhow because I'm going to run out of patients in my own practice eventually. So I want to do a little bit of sleep with my local physicians to get in their office and hopefully for them to want to get in my office so we can play catch with some patients back and forth.
Yeah.
So I've got those two different ways of ordering the sleep test, either locally. Now, in the states where I can't order a sleep test, I can refer that patient to a sleep physician that isn't local, that's a telemedicine doctor. And they're still going to be oral appliance friendly, and they're still going to order the sleep test. But now I'm technically not ordering it. The telemedicine consult with a doctor orders the sleep test. That whole thing costs about $300.
Okay, that was one.
First off, it's covered by medical insurance. So, Yeah. So if patients say, well, what is this, you know, what does this cost? I don't answer that. I say, well, it's actually, it's covered by your medical insurance. I'm reminding them this is not something I'm doing. I don't want to dispense the sleep test. I don't want to give them a sleep test. I want a third party to be the person. Remember the value of this, because we're going to talk about it. I want a third party to be the value that says you have or you don't have sleep apnea. The third party says you should have an oral appliance, or you should have a CPAP, or you don't need treatment at all. Not me. A physician ordered this. I'm just fulfilling the prescription.
Yeah.
I'm the durable medical equipment provider. I'm not the diagnoser, the prescriber. I'm just reading the prescription. It says you need this particular medication, you need this particular knee brace, or in this case, you need an oral appliance.
Yeah. Now, if you're listening to this podcast, you're already thinking, okay, this is really complex. Like, I'm a dentist. Now, Mark, I think you would agree with this. There are people that fix teeth and there are people that change lives. Those are two different practices. You know, one cares about one thing, and not that one is bad and one is good. It's not, you just got to decide. And you've heard this.
Sure.
People are like, oral cancer screening. I mean, I'm not an oncologist. I'm like, you're not, but you're going to save so many lives if you commit yourself to that level of caring for another. So an oral care, you can't even argue, is a oral cancer screening important? It's critical.
Right.
You may not find it all the time, but you're going to find one, at least one in your career, maybe two, maybe four. And that person will forever thank you. And you'll love it that you had it part of your standard of care. Same thing applies here, is you might be thinking, I don't know if I want to integrate this. What if you send somebody for a test and they go, oh my gosh, I'm 30 and I found out I have obstructive sleep apnea. Like, I would have never known that because I'm a runner. I'm a female. I didn't think I would have that. Would you agree with that?
100%. You know, when I lecture, and I think I said this in the screening one, we all do an oral cancer screening at every single hygiene visit. And if I had everybody raise their hands that's listening to that podcast, they all put their hands up because they do that every time. And I said, keep your hand up if you found somebody that had oral cancer in the last 12 months, and almost every hand goes down. If we did that with screening for sleep-related breathing disorders and obstructive sleep apnea, how many of you screen all of your patients at all your visits for that? Very few hands would go up. Of the hands that were up, how many found somebody in the last 6 months? Forget the year, the last 6 months, all the hands would stay up because it's 20 to 25% of your population of your patients. If you recall from the very first beginning, one of the first slides I showed was the kinds of responses we get from patients the next day. You feel like $1 million when patients are sleeping better, they're sleeping soundly, they're not snoring, their spouse is back in the bed with them. We do change lives by treating obstructive sleep apnea. The challenge for us is those conversations where, you know, we're 75% effective rather than 100% effective. You know, if we're changing lives aesthetically and we get those teeth beautiful, we feel like we're going to be 100% when we get that opportunity. So we've got to get comfortable with that. That's the hardest thing about dental sleep medicine. Billing, documentation, big pain in the butt, but you can work around that. You can pay for somebody else to do it. But then you have to be comfortable knowing I'm only going to win 75% of the time. Here's the good news. It's even higher, 89% for me. Our data shows about 89% effective at treating mild and moderates. So maybe you say, I'm going to treat mild and moderates, and I'm going to push all the severes to CPAP, which is what I do. The ones that come back who can't wear CPAP, I treat those, and I'm about 50-50. How would you like to be 50-50 with a patient?
It's great.
Yeah. Super bummer. Yeah. It'd be Hall of Fame again if you're in baseball. But as dentists, we're staying up all night worrying about the other 50% that we weren't able to treat.
Yeah. Let's go further into the test. You talk about types
yeah.
1, 2, 3, and 4, and then what do we focus yep. on? So let's say I am batting 40% or even 30%. These tests are now coming back to me. I got 3 out of 10. What am I looking at? What am I learning? Like, where do I go with that?
Yeah. So there's basically four types of tests. And then there's what we would call consumer wearables. I'm wearing a Fitbit watch right now, and a Fitbit or an Apple watch gives you all kinds of information about the quality of your sleep. But it's technically not a sleep test. My Fitbit has a pulse oximeter in it, which is a component of a sleep test. It's a component of various types of sleep tests. It's important, but it doesn't give me, you know, true rendering information or diagnostic information, but it's useful for the patients. We have patients download SnoreLab on their phone so that they get an app that tells them how loud they snore. So there's a division of sleep tests, 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then there's the consumer wearables. So let's keep those pushed off that way. Type 1 tests are exactly what you were talking about that you had 10 years ago. In a sleep clinic with lots of leads, let's just say lots of leads, lots of information, a chest belt, a chest belt, thoracic belt, abdominal belt, but those are measuring effort, tells you position, there's leads, there's a cannula that comes around your nose to measure flow. There's a pulse oximeter on your finger. It picks up heart rate, picks up what position you're in the bed. There's leads on your legs to measure movement. There's leads that come up to your brain so that it's measuring an electroencephalogram to tell you what's happening with your brain waves, which stage of sleep you're in. So you look like you're wired up like you're some kind of a monster. That's 10 to 15% of the tests today. It used to be, even as frequently as 4 years ago, it used to be as high as about 40% or 50% of the tests. But again, I only need that test, or the patient only needs that test, or the physician only needs that test if we're asking a bigger question than sleep apnea. If we're asking sleep apnea, then a home sleep test is fine. Now, the moment we're not looking at the test, we're not looking at the patient, and it's not an observed test, it can't be a type 1. Type 1s are very complex tests and observed. They're watching you sleep. Type 2 and type 3 tests are similar. They're not observed. And now it's just a question of how much information. That's what makes the difference between a type 2 and a type 3 test. Most of the time, you only need a type 3 test for sleep apnea. The difference between type 2 and type 3 is, do we have leads that tell us the patient's sleep hypnogram? What stage of sleep are they in? Do we have an electroencephalogram? So I use a sleep test occasionally with patients that's called a general sleep, a Z machine, and it's got three leads on the back of the head that give us sleep staging. Are they in deep sleep, stage one, stage two? Are they in REM? Are they awake? I can get that information from that. I don't often need that. So I don't use that test very often when I'm titrating a patient. We'll talk about when we use some of these tests. Most of the time, we'll order up a test. Most of the time, the patient will get a type 3 test, which is chest effort, heart rate, pulse oximeter, nasal flow cannula, all kinds of information like that, positional. Some of the type 3 tests have fewer leads, so maybe there isn't a chest belt for effort. Maybe there isn't a flow meter. So there might be little variations. So when you look at the group of type 3 tests and you say, well, I'm using a type 3 test, and you might say, so are you, and so are you, and so are you, they might be three different tests, and one of them might have 5 leads, one of them might have 9 leads, one of them might have 12 leads. But none of them are going to tell you position. Sometimes it's as simple as it looks like a pulse oximeter on the finger, but there's some very, very smart math and algorithms that can be done with some of the data that comes in from peripheral arterial tomography, called PAT, and then there's PAG technology, that can give you some more of that information just from something that looks like a pulse oximeter. Most sleep physicians won't recognize that simple kind of a test. Most sleep physicians want to see a few more leads, a little fancier type 3 test. So you'll usually see a pretty solid type 3 test or a type 2 test for a home sleep test. And then you'll see some of these simpler type 3 tests used as titration devices. Do I have the patient in the right position? I want to check before I send them for their follow-up sleep test. Because remember, I tested them, they have sleep apnea, I make them an oral appliance, and now I'm going to try and position that in the right spot. And when I get there, we do a follow-up sleep test. Well, before I do that follow-up sleep test, I can check with a simple sleep test or with just a pulse oximeter, or I could choose to use just the patient's subjective symptom improvement to decide, yep, Kirk says he's sleeping better, he's not getting up to go pee as much at night, he's not snoring, everybody's happy, let's go ahead and send him for a follow-up sleep test. Or I could add pulse oximetry, or I could add a simple sleep test. Type 1, type 2, type 3. Type 4 tests, pulse oximeter. Okay. Really just a couple of leads, nothing very comprehensive. Can't use it to diagnose sleep apnea. So it might be just pulse oximetry, what's your SpO2, what's your oxygen levels in your blood, and then your heart rate. That's all the information it's really going to give you. But that's enough for me to get a feel for if I'm in the right position. So I use occasionally a type 1 test, referral to physicians for complex cases, often a type 3 test for home sleep testing that either a company, a doc in the box sends to them, or my local sleep physician will use if it's not a complex case. And then I use pulse oximetry, a type 4 sleep test for measuring, do I think the patient's in the therapeutic position?
Right. Yeah. And that was going to be one of my questions, is the efficacy of like what your thought process is, because you're going to have your tool of choice here, but you're going to need... You know, I would imagine
you need information. Yeah, you need information. So it'd be just like if you're if you say you're treating somebody for periodontitis, and right. So you've arranged this therapy for them to have done, and they're going to have, you know, maybe some gum surgery. They're going to have some deep scaling root planing. What do? You go back and you remeasure the gums. You remeasure the pockets. And so now we're asking the question: maybe is the level of testing, is the level of measuring the pockets that we measure the pocket depth, or are we measuring the attachment loss from the CEJ? Slightly different. So that's like the difference between a type 2 and a type 3 test, or a type 3 and a type 4 test. How much information are we getting in? Also, what's the condition and the color of the tissue? Did it bleed? Did it seem swollen? So how many points of information do you need? And you might need more information at the diagnostic step. You might need more information at the follow-up. Yes, I'm in a good therapeutic step, but along the meantime, I might just need a tiny bit of information like the pulse oximeter to tell me I'm going in the right direction.
Right.
Cholesterol test. Get your blood drawn. Your cholesterol is 350. We put you on this medication. You're done, right? Nope. We come back after you've been on the medication for the prescribed length of time. Retake your blood. Your cholesterol's come down. Not enough. It has been enough. We titrate that. We adjust it. Same thing. That's how medicine works. The bad news is sometimes you advance somebody's mandible out. Sometimes they are uncomfortable, or sometimes they just don't get to a therapeutic position, or sometimes they can't tolerate the device. But 3 out of 4 times, you're going, But 1 out of 4 times, you're not going to be therapeutically successful. And you have to look the patient in the eye and say, this treatment didn't work.
Okay.
You probably need a CPAP or surgery or.
The Best Practices Show with Kirk Behrendt is brought to you exclusively by ACT Dental, the ultimate provider of dental practice management solutions for dentists and their teams. ACT Dental is committed to helping you build a better practice and a better life. If you are looking to grow your production, motivate your team, get back on track, and create the practice you've always dreamed about, look no further. Give us a call at 800-851-8186 or visit us at actdental.com.
Now, I'm going to ask you one question that I've heard comes up.
Mm-hmm.
I can't answer it. I'm going to dish it to you because you live on both sides of the fence. Advancing the mandible, effects long-term on the disc. What do we know for sure? Because functionally trained dentists might struggle with this whole, like, where's the research on the disc long-term? What do we know? Because I've heard that. I've heard that in conversation. I'm like, that's not my area. Sure. Let's ask Mark.
Yeah. So we're jumping a little bit ahead into treatment and side effects, but that's perfectly fine. And it's appropriate to ask and answer this question here. And we'll ask and answer it again in the next section. But so when we take a patient's mandible down and forward, like we have to do in obstructive sleep apnea treatment with an oral appliance, there's consequences.
Right.
There's consequences. The first thing that I would tell you is your airway is more important than whether or not you have a good bite. Your airway is more important than whether or not we have some minor side effects that bother a dentist.
Right.
Your airway trumps everything.
Agreed.
Now, having said that, here's the good news. With today's, not 10 years ago when you were getting your sleep test, with today's types of devices, we see fewer side effects because they're better designed, they're more precise. There's a lot of things we can do. And when we talk about device design, I'll spend a lot of time about how important precision is. The other thing is, if we don't have to come down as far forward, it'll be easier for you to get your bite back every morning, because every night, when I pull your jaws down and forward, your temporal mandibular joints and the spaces fill with fluid. And now when you go to close in the morning, when you get up, you're only touching on your front teeth.
Yep.
And there's a posterior open bite. It's about the thickness of 1 or 2 sheets of paper. It feels like it's 1.5 feet, but it's very small. And by just squeezing your teeth together and playing with your bite, you'll probably push all the fluid out of your joint and your teeth will come back together. But just in case they don't, we make what's called a morning realigner or a morning occlusal guide to help position your jaw back in that position. So we play this silly game. Every night, I pull your jaw down and forward. Your joints fill with fluid. Every morning, you push it back. Play that game every day. If you're diligent about your part of the game, I will be diligent about my part of the game, your bite won't change. If I make you a device that fits well and fits like a retainer, your teeth won't move. So we should not expect to see any bite changes or tooth movement in oral appliance therapy. Should not expect to see. But if the patient's non-compliant, I can't fix that. Okay. Yeah. If the patient won't wear their morning aligner and they go 5 or 6 days and their bite's changed and they haven't gotten it back, we might never get it back. I care, but I don't care. I care that I wish all the teeth touched because that's how they came into me, but their airway is more important than their bite.
Yeah.
Having said that, in 4 years, of going back to doing this more often. So I dedicate a day a week doing dental sleep medicine now, and the rest of the time I teach and lecture and do the stuff I'm doing now. We haven't had one patient who's lost their bite permanently or discontinued use because of bite or tooth movement changes. but it's partly because of the devices we use. And it's largely because we beat the hell out of them with reminders about wearing this morning occlusal guide. We make them a couple of them that they put in the morning if they need to. Probably half my patients don't, but every one of my patients is conscious about it's their responsibility to get their bite back. Yeah. And so they do a great job of that.
Yeah.
Now, the good news is if somebody has temporomandibular joint problems, if they have joint pain or if they have muscle pain or if they're clenchers or grinders, here's the great news. When you bring them down and forward, almost all of them get better almost immediately.
Yeah.
It doesn't complicate things. It makes almost everybody better. So the dentist who says, ooh, I don't want to do dental sleep medicine because I'll be screwing around with the temporomandibular joints. Great. Send them to me. I'll be happy to see those patients for you.
All right. Now, I know I really jumped the gun because we're not even in the treating, but I this is why this show is so important. I get bombarded and I hear this and I'm just like you, if you're listening, like, I don't know, let's throw them out there to the experts and present both sides. Like so let's get back to the testing. So, okay, now I'm getting these tests back and I'm looking at them. Mark, what do I do on the test results? Like, who reviews them? Mm-hmm. What do I do after that?
Yeah. So I do review them with most of my patients. Every physician you work with is going to be different. Some physicians want to review the sleep test results with the patients. Okay. My physicians, the physicians I work with, every one of them that I work with wants me to do that. Okay. But it could be either way.
Right.
If you're using the doc in the box, and I hate to call it that, that's not fair, but if you're using a telemedicine visit, doc in the box, I just think it's cute. If you use a doc in the box kind of thing, they have a telemedicine option, yes or no, and they can turn that on. And you need that in those states that I talked about. Some of my patients use that. I've got a call later on today with a patient who's going to have their consult with the physician, telemedicine. They didn't have to, they chose to. They probably, they're in their insurance company, probably paid an extra $75 for that or something. Sleep test might've been about $300. The doc in the box call might've been $75, $90. I don't know, whatever it is. It's covered by their medical insurance. And so they're going to have a call with them and then I'll talk to them afterwards. So who reviews the data from the standpoint of interpretation of the study and rendering a diagnosis is always the physician, 100% of the time. They will write a letter of medical necessity for treatment and a prescription for either a CPAP, an oral appliance, or some other kind of therapy. So they're always the physician making all of the high-level decisions, but they might delegate to me, and they usually do, that I look at the sleep test results, I get on a call with you, Kirk, I text you just like I texted this patient, and I said, when's a good time tomorrow? When I got his sleep test results back yesterday to get on a call to review your sleep test results. And he said, I've got a call with the physician at such and such time. I said, great, let's do it after that. So I'm going to go on. And in his case, it'll be a little different consultation. But most of the time, I'm the only human conversation that they have about their sleep test. So I'm responsible to say to them, you have mild, moderate, severe, or you do not have obstructive sleep apnea. If it's mild or moderate and the prescription says so, great news. We can probably make you an oral appliance. Let's get you scheduled for that. If it's severe, it probably says you should try CPAP, and I send them back to the local physician or to my local physician if they came from the teledoc thing and say, this cat needs a CPAP or any other prescription that might be on there. The things we go over with them is I say to them, it turns out that 17 times per hour or 33 times per hour or 6 times per hour, whatever the number is on the AHI score, remember that apnea hypopnea index we talked about,
right?
That's how many times per hour that you weren't getting enough air, that your breathing was restricted enough, that you weren't getting enough air, and your blood oxygen levels dropped enough that you woke up not consciously. That was happening to you 20 times an hour. That's every 3 minutes. Every 3 minutes you were waking up. No wonder you're tired during the day. No wonder you're not feeling as rested. No wonder you have to get up and go pee so much. But here's the other thing. Your blood oxygen level went down what we call the nadir, the lowest amount that it went down to while they were sleeping. So we usually identify that amount. We'll say it went down as low as 83%. I said, that's like being on top of Mount Everest. Okay. That's like being on Kilimanjaro. You're going to die if you stay very long up there. That's how deprived of oxygen your body was during that. We also talk about their minimum and maximum heart rate because people, I'll use my own data. My resting heart rate's around 40, 42, but my sleeping heart rate's around 50. Why is that? Because when I do have my 4 or 5 times per hour, which is less than, you know, more than my hour appliance, so it's less than I would if I didn't wear it, 20 times per hour if I don't, my heart rate shoots up to 90 or 100, 120. So we talk to them about their minimum, their average, and their highest heart rate. Your heart rate was shooting up to 110 sometimes while you're sleeping. That's why people like you who have sleep apnea are at such risk for heart attack. You're laying down and sleeping. You're supposed to be resting. How does your heart rate go to 110? It's because your body thinks you're pushing a car out of a snowbank, but you're laying down and sleeping. And that's why your heart's not prepared to take on that burden. And so many people have heart attacks. Am I putting a little bit of fear in them? Well, hell yes, I am, because it is a serious disease. And they're 23 times more likely to die of a heart attack if they have sleep apnea. And I want them to move on to get treatment. So I go over the AHI score. I go over the NADER, how low their oxygen went. I talk about their high and their low heart rate. And then generally, if there's anything else of interest in there, but those are the points I almost always review with them. And I say, so I said, what I'd like to do is let's get you in as soon as possible and get you started towards better breathing at night while you're sleeping. And that's making an oral appliance for you or sending you back for a CPAP, whatever it might be. And again, now we're in that same conversation as we were with the sleep test. 8 out of 10 patients go, okay. And once in a while, somebody says, well, what does that cost? And I remind them it's covered by their medical insurance, because sometimes they forget that just because I'm a dentist, that this is going to be dentistry and it's all going to come out of their pocket. And it usually doesn't. Usually medical insurance is excellent coverage, but sometimes people have a $5,000 deductible and they want to know. And if they ask me that second time, remember what we said, if they ask me again, well, what's this going to cost? I said, well, you know, it's covered by your medical insurance. They said, well, listen, I have a $5,000 deductible and it's January or February, so I'm going to pay this whole thing. I said, well, here's the good news, Kirk. You have Blue Cross and I'm in network with Blue Cross. I play like I'm in network with all of them. Isn't that funny? I was non-par as a dentist with all insurances and I'm in par with every medical insurance. So I go, we participate with Blue Cross, Blue Shield, and their maximum allowable fee for this is $2,456. So that's the most it could cost you out of pocket. What the patient heard was, not $2,456, what the patient heard was, there's a third party that they trust, their medical insurance, that said, that's a fair fee.
Right.
That's what they heard. Yeah. So now, because they don't know what it should or shouldn't cost, but they know they need this. If I've done my job, they know they need this. It's okay to be curious what it's going to cost, especially if you got a $5,000 deductible. And we just treated a patient. We just delivered her device earlier this week. And I remember I saw her and her husband for the consultations. She has sleep apnea. He doesn't. So she came back in and we're getting treated. And they wanted to wait till January. Usually people want to get it done by the end of the year because they have met their deductible and everything. She said, we almost always meet our deductible. So I'd love to start off next year with this. So I know I already have it behind me. Isn't that crazy? But that's good financial planning really on her part, because she knows she's going to have a lot of medical costs. She's got like a $1,500 deductible. So let's get it started with this. And then the rest of the year, she'll be free rolling.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's go back to this though. I think this moment, you said the fear thing. I want to go back to that. This is a moment of truth for patients, because some dentists, I think every dentist listening to this would go, I totally get it. Now it's your job as the lead here who knows what this is all about or has a perspective. Like, I think you got to tell the patients the truth, because some dentists might be
absolutely
listening. Mark, you know, you're putting fear in this patient's, I think this, number one, diagnosis is neutral. It's not punitive. It's not harmful. You're just telling them the truth. Wouldn't you agree? Like, and so
100%.
I think you got to get into like telling them the truth. And then also too, like with that patient, hey, look, you can wait. Let's just hope you don't have a heart attack before that. Do you know what I mean? Type of a thing. So I don't know. I struggle with that because in our efforts.
So I always like to do this. I always like to say, turn it around the other way, turn it around completely the other way. So you see a patient who you think's at risk and you don't encourage them to get a test.
Right.
And they die. And you could have saved their life. Is that your partial responsibility? Well, that's a discussion I don't want to have. Now you've got somebody who has a positive test result. And you paint the picture as, well, if you kind of want to and you're interested, you might want to go get this device thing and they die. And you could have saved their life. You feel the responsibility of that?
Hell yes.
Would we ever consider not telling a patient they have periodontal disease? Would we ever consider not telling a patient that they need that third molar out? Would we ever consider not telling a patient that that tooth can be saved with endodontic therapy? No. Then why in the hell would we shy away from something that is far more serious, far more life-threatening? We are going to see lawsuits down the road because of the ADA resolution that says we should be screening. You're going to see a lawsuit from some savvy lawyer in 3 or 5 or 7 years of a patient who died, who was a regular patient in a practice for 20 years, who was over 50, obese, huge neck, and had a conversation, and no one had recommended a test. No one had talked to them about sleep apnea. The patient dies, and there's going to be somebody who's going to come back and ask to pay hell for that. I assure you, just like undiagnosed periodontitis, which doesn't happen much anymore, but it's still the most litigated activity in dentistry today.
Yeah, you could That's go crazy. On and on and on. I'm a cardiologist. Your LAD, lower end, you know, it's partially blocked. There's some, it's fine. We're not, we don't need to take a closer look at that. Like there are.
Yeah. So I don't want the responsibility of not being forthcoming and not being transparent. Like you, I loved your statement. Diagnosis is not judgmental. Is that what you said?
It's neutral.
It's neutral. Diagnosis is neutral. It's a test. Here's the number. Here, yeah, first off, and that's important. Here's the scorecard. 0 to 5, normal. 5 to 15, mild. 15 to 30, moderate. 30 and north, south. Here's the scorecard. Here's the test. Oh, you got a 22. See, that's very neutral. Here's the scorecard. Take the test. Here's your score.
And let's tell dentists why. In our effort to not overwhelm patients, we often underwhelm them. You're like, oh, I can't tell. This is pretty heavy with the periodontal and the bite issue, and like she doesn't have any money. She's gonna cry. She's gonna be overwhelmed. Well, I didn't tell her the truth, and now the problem gets bigger or continues on.
Absolutely,
you know.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, why would you never watch a little cancer that was just getting started? You would never watch a little tumor that was growing. But why do we watch decay? I'm gonna watch that. No, it's either needs to be treated or it doesn't. And maybe when it's really small, you treat it as a very small incipient sort of lesion and you're able to fix it and restore it so that patient never has any other consequence from that the rest of their lifetime. What an incredible service that is. Well, it's the same thing in medicine. Ah, your cholesterol is a little high. We'll watch it get a little higher. We'll watch it get a little higher. We'll watch it get a little higher. And then you have a heart attack and die. Sleep apnea. And again, we're not trying to be physicians here. You don't have to be an endodontist, an orthodontist, a periodontist. You don't have to be an oral surgeon. You don't have to treat those specialty activities. No one is suggesting that. I think what's being suggested is while we're in the mouth looking around, while we have these patients that we're seeing every 6 months, there are some things that we should be paying attention to and that we should screen for. And there's a list of them. Everything from oral cancer to periodontitis to sleep-related breathing disorders. This is one more thing.
Amen, brother. Now, our next episode, we're going to go into the treating, but any last thoughts you have, Mark, on the testing component?
Yeah, I would say that testing is where the rubber hits the road in the decision-making process for a patient. They need to feel, there's a term called moments of impact, where clarity comes for us or for a patient in our lives where we make clear decisions based on information that we are provided. I want to create a potential moment of impact for that patient to either celebrate that they don't have sleep apnea or be prepared to act if they do. And so if you think of everything leading up to the test results being around creating a need for information so that they can have clarity to make a decision about their own future health care, just like we would in dentistry, that frames that discussion well enough so that when they get the test results back, they sort of self-appoint themselves to be ready for treatment rather than us having to have this big, long closing case presentation thing like we have to do in dentistry. And it's all covered by their medical insurance. And that sounds like a flippant discussion, but being covered by their medical insurance is an important consideration. That's for sure. Yeah, it makes treatment a lot easier.
We're going to go heavy in that in the billing and documentation, and you're going to flip some paradigms that I've even had on my head because it's an incredible opportunity when you know the truth about it. So I love this. Now, Mark, let's say I'm a 32-year-old dentist. I'm totally picking up what you're putting down right now. What do you do? How do I find you? Where do I go? Where do I start? Like what does your company do?
So ProSomnus makes the medical devices that we use for treating patients with obstructive sleep apnea. And so we don't really provide education, although that's kind of what I do. We don't provide a formal education with CE credits or anything like that. We don't have a billing company. We don't have a software platform. So anybody could email me at mmurphy@prosomnus.com, prosomnus.com. And I'm happy to hook them up and they can have some conversations with two or three different billers or two or three different softwares. But it's really about getting the training first so that you know what you need to know to screen, and then you know what you need to know if you want to treat, and then you go forward from there. And there are excellent partners out there that will help you navigate the minefield of living in the medical world. Some of those same, by the way, some of those same medical billing companies that you work with for dental seat medicine also can help you with other activities in your practice, like temporomandibular disorders, like implants. There are some of those procedures that are covered under medical plans. And so those same billing companies often find very neat ways to get some of that stuff that should be covered under the medical plan. They're not making crap up, but some of that stuff that should be covered under the medical plan, some of them are very effective at getting that done as well.
Yeah, I love it. So I'm going to encourage you, if you're listening and this makes sense to you, or even a little bit of sense, reach out to Mark and his great company, ProSomnus. You're going to love it. And then also, if you haven't listened to the previous episodes, if you're looking at your feed right now, let's just say you're looking at your phone, you're listening to iTunes, and you just happened on this episode, you can scroll up to the other ones on basic sleep physiology screening. And then you could even scroll down, which we haven't shot yet, but they will. They're going to show up. You're going to see Mark's to go into the treatment. You know,
by the time they're scrolling, they'll be shot.
By the time you're scrolling, you'll be able to see it, and then you'll also see the final episode that we do in this series, which is going to be on the billing and documentation. You'll absolutely love it. Each one of them is going to have show notes. So if you click on it, you can even in this episode, just click on the show notes, scroll up to it. You're going to see Mark's email address. I'll make this easy for you. You can just tap on it. It'll create an email for you. You can email Mark directly. So make sure you check that out. If you enjoyed today, do us a favor. Just hit the share button. Share this episode with your friends. It's not only going to improve their practice, but change people's lives. I believe in it. Mark, I know you believe in it. And I can't thank you enough, brother. I'm excited to do the next episode.
So, talk to you soon.
You got it. So you guys, until we see you again, keep listening to the Best Practices Show. You guys enjoy the rest of your day.
There you have it. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Best Practices Show. I hope you sure did enjoy it. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to us. We are always here for you. And if you haven't done so already, make sure you subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you consume podcasts. And if you really enjoy it, you can leave a comment or a 4 or 5 star review. But until we see you next time, keep watching the Best Practices Show.